bringing light to what's going on. Lisa Nomura, you're an amazing woman.
You are amazing.
I appreciate you so much.
And thanks, Jerry Silva. Keep this line going.
Thank you, Jerry. And thank you so much to all of our listeners. Happy
Thanks,
Sunday.
Laura.
Thank you, Laura. And happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. All the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear. For the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish I could get.
Big up Southern California, this is Ziggy Marley and your free speech radio station KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles and 98.7 in Santa Barbara. Support.
Hello, this is Alan Minsky sitting in for Susie Weissman on Beneath the Surface today, live in studio at KPFK, and I'm joined by my partner in crime, Melissa Figueroa. How you doing, Melissa?
Good. How are you, Alan?
Good. Great. And, you know, we've worked on Susie's show forever, and or so it seems, though it was, in fact, a really great show before I even started working on it, which is, wow, a long time ago, more than two decades ago. But I just want to say before we get going today, you know, to follow the show Think Outside the Cage, you know, I do a lot of work in now in, you know, rather high-profile American political activism. And anybody out there in American society who looks out upon other societies in the world or other societies historically and has these kind of sharp criticisms about the inhumanity of the society and their social organization, I don't think there's any greater human rights abuse in the world ongoing than the U.S. Carceral system. I mean, the warehousing of hundreds of thousands and millions of people in the United States of America, this wealthy country, is really just an absolutely appalling reality that we live with every day and we just sort of accept, and it's ongoing, and it is absolutely criminal. And I think every metropolitan area in the country should have its own Think Outside the Cage. And, you know, as far as the politics that I work to try to achieve in my life, until the U.S. prison industrial complex is no longer a thing, then my politics will have been a failure. So I'm really proud still to have worked at KPFK and to have helped develop that show, and so proud that it's still on the airways here. So. And of course, a great station that has Beneath the Surface on with Susie Weissman. So how are you doing today, Mel?
I'm doing okay on this Sunday morning. Looks like there's a lot of turmoil in the Democratic Party, which we'll be talking about in this hour.
And stability in the Republican Party. And that stability, I mean, it's strange to think that Donald Trump now is that source of stability in the American political system. But so it seems. And what we're going to talk about today is, well, we are going to take calls from listeners later in the hour. First, we're going to hear from Professor Harvey J.K., and he's going to talk about a project that I worked on him with called 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights, a specific proposal. There have been a few iterations of that, and I think the one that Harvey and I have worked on is now one of the higher profile ones, and we introduced it in 2022. And we're going to hear a clip. I want to go back to his original introduction of the idea to the group that I work with now. So it's a clip from a Progressive Democrats of America event, but he is so eloquent on this. And the reason I bring it up now, and I think it's important to frame the contemporary political moment around, is if you look at the Republican convention and the shift that has taken place inside the Republican Party now, especially with the naming of J.D. Vance as the vice president, is something of a consolidation. Certainly it represents a consolidation of the party to be organized more completely around Donald Trump. And what can be broadly understood as sort of Trumpian politics, which, as we know, are sort of a vague term because Trump is, of course, whatever Trump says he is at any moment, as a true patriarch, right? The one iron law of patriarchy is no matter how incoherent or nonsensical, whatever the father says goes. And that's the world of Donald Trump, of course. And J.D. Vance, though, I think on two very important fronts does represent a significant shift in the Republican Party. First of all, on foreign policy, I think, though he, in this sense, Trump equivocates, but I think Vance has more significantly, even more significantly than Trump, tipped his hand in terms of almost a heading towards a bit of a Ron Paul type foreign policy, though not anything as consistent or logically consistent as Ron Paul back in the day, but that they would oppose potentially U.S. involvement with NATO, for instance. And so Vance being named as the vice president, and this is a very contentious issue within the Republican Party. This still remains a very significant faction within the Republican Party that is, of course, all about empire maintenance. And it's not to say that Trump and Vance won't advocate for U.S. empire, but they lean towards a set of positions that, again, echo the traditional isolationist point of view of we shouldn't be spending all this money in foreign expenditures. It should be going to the American public. Certainly Vance echoed that. And again, that's a significant shift inside. Even if it's not fully realized, it is a significant shift in the Republican Party. And then the other one is, of course, domestically. And this is maybe much more to the point because there's no doubt that there'll be considerable forces that will impact the way this election plays out related to foreign policy. That's probably going to be more at the level of major donations. It's possible that that will enter into public consciousness and become a significant factor. It's certainly something that's been talked about in the political discourse in the country over the past few years. But generally, the American public is going to be voting on economics. And even Israel and Gaza at the height of its dominance of the news cycle, if you looked at the public opinion polls, it really was still very much a lesser issue for the general public than the average household struggles with inflation and the sense of the economy burying them, even though it has recovered obviously substantially from the COVID times. And so Vance definitely signifies a rhetorical shift in the Republican Party, a very significant. If you go from any of the iterations of the Republican Party, from Ronald Reagan through Mitt Romney, of course, you have a party that very much is the party of entrepreneurship and small business, and those are the metaphors that are echoed. Whereas in J.D. Vance, and this picks up from a lot of Trump, you know, echoes the what does Trump call it, the American. In the first inaugural, his only inaugural speech to date, but the absolute wasted landscape, you know, of America. And, of course, Vance's work in Hillbilly Elegy is reflective of that, even though, of course, he pretty much comes around to an ideology of blaming the victims in that case, right? And but still, economically, there's an element of populism. He even brings in unions in his own speaking. We had the head of the Teamsters speak. So now the Democratic Party is up next, and of course they're in utter chaos, and we'll talk about that hopefully when we take calls from listeners interested to hear what people think about. Do they think Joe Biden should stay as the nominee? Do they think Kamala Harris is the best person to replace him? Whatever you want to say about all of that mess, and even the mess about the mess itself, is worth hearing from the listeners about later in the hour. But when it comes to the Democratic Party and how they are going to counter this almost effort to claim a progressive economic mantle from the Republican Party, that's why I want to play the 21st Century Bill of Rights introduction that we did with PDA and with Harvey J.K. And talk about the ways in which an actual political economy that addresses the needs of working class people across the country is starkly in contrast not only to the Republican, what's being presented by Vance and Trump, which is really quite marginal compared to what really needs to happen in terms of, you know, addressing wealth inequality and providing a pathway to, you know, a much more materially prosperous and secure life for working Americans. And the contrast between that and the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights, but then the contrast between the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights and the ways in which the Biden administration has moved us closer to that than we maybe would have expected with the Biden administration, but we're still well short of it. And I will be pointing those things out after we hear from Harvey. But then also the problem that maybe the Democrats are going to face, and this maybe goes to Bernie Sanders' point in defending Biden at this hour, which is that I think Bernie understands that all of these governors, including the ones who have sort of been tapped to be more progressive than the others, so I suppose that's Shapiro and Whitmer, and Kamala Harris herself, they're the products of the neoliberal Democratic Party. And there's not evidence of the kind of shift that you have seen with Biden over these past few years to a break, at least, with neoliberal orthodoxy. Again, there's hints of it with Shapiro and maybe even some substance with Whitmer, but not that much of it. Certainly nothing is as strong as going back to social democratic policies or FDR-esque policies or the kind of things we outlined in the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights or, of course, the Sanders platforms. Not much at all from them. And also, you lose a lot of historical knowledge when you shift from Joe Biden to these other people. Now, that's not to defend Biden and certainly not to defend his candidacy, because that's just common sense right now. I mean, this is a guy who, I mean, the thing about Biden is he's almost certain to lose the election. I mean, simply because the way that people vote seems to be so much on presentation and character. And the problem, I think, that really is really glaring with the Democrats continuing, if they were to continue to prop up Biden, and again, it sort of saddens me to say this, it is that, one of the main cornerstones of the Democratic Party in 2016 and 2020, so successfully in 2020 and a failure in 2016 against Donald Trump, was that at least they are the party of being truthful per material evidence as it's available at the top of the headlines. That's sort of shattered with the idea of putting forward Biden as a guy who can do this job for the next 4 years and even do the job for the next few weeks. Anyway, with that, Melissa, any thoughts on all that before we hear from Harvey J.K.?
Well, I mean, it certainly is a precarious moment. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting because in 2016, it was like at the time, like Biden probably would have been a better candidate than Hillary Clinton, probably mm-hmm. wouldn't have mm-hmm. lost to Trump. But of course now, it's almost 10 years down the line. So right. A lot has changed since then. I get what you say in terms of the Kamala and Harris and that being the sort of a generation, which honestly started with Obama, if you really want to look at it.
Right.
Well-educated sort of black upper class, and then also, really steeped in neoliberal ideology. Biden, while there's a lot of things that's wrong with him, he at least had policies. And again, where I work in my day job, we'd get federal funding and we deal with federal funding. And so there were some opportunities in these new federal funding programs, like the Inflation Reduction Act and stuff, for progressive things to be enacted from that funding if like municipalities, localities, and state governments were ready for it, which they weren't. But, this is also a challenge for the grassroots as we go forward. I want reminding people that, the state of politics as it affects people's daily lives, doesn't end in Washington, D.C. in the president's office. There's,
right.
There's many, many things. And this is why there's a lot of hope for something like a 21st century economic bill of rights, it's not dead if the president is not a progressive, you know what I mean? And so there's some hope there. There's some room for maneuver. At this point, honestly, youth vote is at an all-time low.
Yeah.
People are hurting. People mm-hmm. are hurting. And, the populism that you talked about earlier can really be dangerous if the Democratic Party, and that's what the fight is going to be at the DNC in mm-hmm. August, is over this platform.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, people do care about what's going to happen in their daily lives, and having a strong set of like promises, even like mm-hmm. even if it's just promises to the American public, could go a long way in sort of defeating Vance and his Peter Thiel inspired Silicon Valley fascism.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so, you know, it's there's so much up in the air, but at the same time, there's a lot of window of opportunity mm-hmm. And openings to be able to put forward a strong, you know, argument and a case for incorporating some progressive policies into the platform, you know, no matter who is the nominee.
Yeah, and so what we're going to do now is we're going to play a clip of Professor Harvey J. Kay talking about the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights, which is a proposal that he and I co-authored and put forward back in 2022. There's been some even more recent iterations of it. It did make it into some federal legislation through Representative Barbara Lee and Pramila Jayapal in the Third Reconstruction Act. It was folded into that, and we are looking and hoping in the next Congress to introduce it as a standalone bill. It was a framing that Bernie Sanders supported in the 2020 campaign, though he didn't really highlight it much, though he supported it. And it's something that's gained a good amount of momentum over the past few years. But again, as we're now in this race, and there's not really a progressive, and it hasn't really been a good season, by the way, for progressives. We shouldn't mince words about that. But especially with the defeat of Jamal Bowman in New York, but hopefully Cori Bush can pick up and defend her seat. We may have a progressive pickup in Arizona in next week, and also hopefully defending Ilhan Omar and the rest of the squad going forward. But, you know, when we take calls, I would love to hear from anybody who has any insights on Kamala Harris. I do think she is next person to basically take center stage in world history. And she, of course, was a prosecutor, effectively, right? She was a city attorney, and then she was the attorney general in California, not a particularly progressive one. And she was only a legislator for 4 years, during which time Mitch McConnell ran the U.S. Senate, had control of the Senate, Republicans had the majority. So there were very few votes of significance that she took. She had a platform when she ran both for Senate and for president. But again, especially around political economics, with the understanding that those are the key issues that people will vote on, if anybody can provide insight on Kamala Harris on that front or anything they want to share at all about, again, the former California Attorney General and current Vice President, the likely heir at this hour and the likely nominee of the Democratic Party, it's probably either going to be Joe Biden or Kamala Harris. I put about a 5 to 10% chance of anybody else. So with that, let's go to the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights and hear now the voice of Harvey J. Kay, Professor Harvey J. Kay.
For the record. So anyhow, I've taken the responsibility of presenting this economic bill of rights, and I'll just repeat something I've said here a couple of times, a few times before, and that is we're in progressive Democrats. We are small p and small d progressive Democrats because we know that the Democratic Party that I assume the vast majority of us actually vote for has turned its back on the progressive tradition. Okay. And we cannot afford to have that continue. We are confronting the crisis of American democratic life. And I want to be all the more specific about it. For all too long, the democratic achievements of generations, especially the generation of the 30s into the 40s and the generation of the 60s, and those two decidedly overlap, okay, and the generation of the 30s and 40s were the parents of those of us who were the generation of the 60s. The democratic achievements of those generations regarding workers' rights, women's rights, and the rights of people of color, most especially, obviously, African Americans, the right to vote, which affects even more than people of color, given the way the laws are being put together to deny those rights, that we just can't allow this to continue. And the problem is that the Democrats to this day have yet to be able to engage, to really speak to Americans, their needs, their wants, and to engage their aspirations in a fashion that, as I said, Nina Turner is eager to do, that encourages the fight in the American people. Now, you can practically hear FDR's words of 1933 in his inaugural address, the words, where there is no vision, the people perish. And that's the situation we are in today. So Alan and I, in our own dialectical way, perhaps, we came up with this idea that PDA would be the should be the primary vehicle, the primary force to redeem and to advance something that has been at the center, even though it's been marginalized in maybe in public memory and all too often in politics. It's been very central to the progressive tradition ever since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And that is the idea that the promise of the Declaration of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness must entail the ability and the power to realize life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which FDR promised, believing that a generation was ready to pursue it, and they were. The four freedoms of freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, and freedom from want, and freedom from fear, which he then articulated in an all the more, if you like, almost like visionary, but yet blueprint-like way in the economic, his call for an economic bill of rights, a second bill of rights in 1944. So it was 41, the four freedoms, and then he came back in 44 to project the possibility of a second bill of rights. But it wasn't only FDR. I mean, it didn't happen because big business, Republicans, and Southern Democrats were not about to allow it to happen, and a conservative coalition emerged to prevent it. But it didn't die as an idea, and there were those who grabbed hold of it again. A. Philip Randolph, the great labor and civil rights leader in 1965, proposed a freedom budget. And the way it's presented, it is clearly, if you like, it is clearly all the more a blueprint for realizing the four freedoms and an economic bill of rights. And by contemporary dollar terms, it seems small. He proposed $10 billion freedom budget. But in its day, that was huge. And 150 labor leaders, civil rights leaders, foundation leaders, and academic and intellectual leaders endorsed it. It was not out of the question for it to be embraced by the Johnson administration that had already proposed and pursued the initiatives known as the Great Society and the War on Poverty. But of course, the war in Vietnam drained the resources from the American purse, and thus the administration pursued the war and not the freedom budget. Three years later, not long before his assassination, Martin Luther King Jr. once again published a call for, in Look magazine, and I believe in various other publications, an economic bill of rights. And we know most recently, the man whom probably most of us, if not all of us, voted for in the primaries of 2020, Bernie Sanders proposed, and it's available on his website, an economic bill of rights for the 21st century. So Alan and I thought, well, this is the time. I mean, just as Roosevelt knew from polls back in the 40s that Americans wanted such an affirmation of rights, and just as Johnson actually knew in the 60s, and had he not been so committed to the war in Vietnam, might well have picked it up, we know that ever since the 30s, Americans have wanted this kind of thing, and we know today they do. How do we know this? The polling shows us, but also the way Americans in the majority have voted. They have voted for an agenda, right, that implies that the economic bill of rights. But the time now is to propose a vision and a project for progressives to rally around and for progressive candidates to embrace. So Alan and I sat down and we put together what we would think of as a draft. It's not yet really a true manifesto, because there's elements to be worked out, and I'm sure Alan wouldn't mind my saying it, the poetry has yet to be fully. This was a conversation we had. It needs a little more poetry. But right now, we can think of it as a call for an economic bill of rights and a call for Americans who think of themselves as progressive or liberal or just generally Americans in the best sense of the word can rally around. So I'm going to read this if it's okay, and I'll try not to do it in a dull fashion. This is what we've arrived at so far. In his 1944 State of the Union address, President Franklin Roosevelt articulated popular American aspirations by calling for an economic bill of rights as a necessary addition to the original Bill of Rights. Polls conducted by the White House in 1943 revealed that after the war, Americans wanted guaranteed health care, guaranteed employment, and guaranteed aid to students. Empowered by those findings, FDR declared, and these are his words, "We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. Therefore, we have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. All of which is as true today as it was 78 years ago. Therefore, Progressive Democrats of America, PDA, proposes a 21st century economic Bill of Rights. A Bill of Rights we call on all progressive candidates and office holders to embrace. I think it's essential that those who would dare to call themselves progressive dare to embrace this economic Bill of Rights." Sorry, that's my insertion. Let me go back to the text. "A 21st century economic Bill of Rights will guarantee all people residing in the United States the right to the basic necessities of life, regardless of their income, race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or country of origin. A 21st century economic Bill of Rights will establish that all Americans are entitled to." You may have already looked at this short list of six. We've amended it slightly, and I have it here exactly as we've amended it. I'm sure you'll find no trouble with this as it is. At least I hope so. Here they are: the right to a job with a living wage and a union. We tried to keep these direct and short and to the point. The right to quality health care, the right to a complete education and broadband internet access, the right to affordable housing, the right to a clean environment, the right to recreation and a secure retirement. Now, these are essentially drawn, with some amendment, from Bernie Sanders' roster. I will tell you that FDR's original clearly inspired and influenced us, and I think in some ways his offers a little more poetry, and we'll try to be more poetic if we go forward with this. Anyhow, as I said, these are concise, and they're memorable. We believe they advance a fine starting point. We should also note that there have been various academic proposals by Mark Paul, William Darity, and Derek Hamilton in 2018 for a 21st century economic Bill of Rights. And we should also make clear from my Wisconsin vantage point that two state assembly women, Francesca Hong of Madison and my own representative, Christina Shelton, have proposed a Wisconsin economic justice Bill of Rights, which will be launched all the more energetically this March from the floor of the state capitol, I believe. The chance of it being accepted by the Republican legislature, you can imagine, okay? The point is that this is happening. There's a possibility for real traction, and PDA is the organization to create that kind of movement and traction. Now, we've said, additionally, embracing this new Bernie Sanders 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights will make it all the more clear what distinguishes progressive Democrats from both moderate Democrats and, needless to say, Republicans. That only progressive Democrats truly stand for the type of economy and society that the overwhelming majority of Americans support. That's the key point, that the overwhelming majority of Americans support. Progressive Democrats support the proposition that if you do a full day's work at a full-time job, you deserve economic security and a promising life. Indeed, all Americans deserve economic security and a promising life. Progressive Democrats support policies that provide health care, housing, and retirement security as a human right. By the way, FDR in his own committee's recommendation, they said Americans deserve a chance for adventure. I love that. Okay. Progressive Democrats support well-funded public education. I think Alan spoke to that at the very top of the meeting. K through college and graduate school and professional school, and eliminating the student debt trap for past, present, and future generations. Progressive Democrats support policies that actually address the climate emergency instead of just tinkering with it, as we refuse to do the bidding of the fossil fuel industry, incentivizing investment in renewable energy and domestic manufacturing in the process. In short, progressive Democrats, not moderate or corporate Democrats or the conservative or reactionary GOP, support a platform of policies designed to enable Americans, all Americans, to both secure the nation's promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and make America progressively better in the process. We reject the cynicism that says we can do little to remedy the endemic social ills that have caused so many to lose faith in our national project. And in contrast to those who...
Oh, okay. Well, we are back, and this is Alan Minsky here live at KPFK Radio here with Melissa Figueroa. And we are going to be taking your phone calls at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Let us know what you think about our proposal for a 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. Let us know what you think about, you know, hey, do you think Joe Biden should stay on as a Democratic nominee? And if not, who do you think should replace him? And what do you think about, again, anybody who maybe has a... you know, information they want to share about Kamala Harris, who I think right now looks like the odds-on likely Democratic nominee for president to be up against Donald Trump. And, of course, you know, she was a Californian, Northern Californian, but, you know, statewide elected official. And, you know, maybe people tracked her political economic proposals, which I think will be front and center in this campaign, but haven't been front and center in her career. So, again, any insight people can provide there, I think she... definitely ran when she ran for president with a more or less progressive but not left progressive economic set of policies. Of course, she initially supported Medicare for All, and then she claimed she didn't. That was somewhat of a famous snafu in that campaign. But anyway, I do want to say that Professor Harvey J. Kay, along with a great Midwestern activist and radio host, Hartzell Gregg, will be joining us on our PDA Town Hall later today to talk about the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights in the context of the 2024 election, much as we are doing right now, but also about the Progressive Central event that we are planning PDA is hosting in Chicago on August 18th and 19th, where the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights will be central to, again, our sort of our adamancy that the progressive electoral political thrust must remain vibrant, and it must continue to present itself as the politics within the electoral realm that the American public wants and the society needs. And so that will be today at 1 p.m. Pacific time. And you can find out information about that town hall at pdamerica.org. And but you can always find that on YouTube, because you should also listen to Middle East in Focus, which is a great show on KPFK at 1 o'clock. So I want to say that, too. So your thoughts right now, Mel?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Like, you know, as the clip was playing, I was sort of doing some reading up on the Democratic Party platform that's being proposed. And, you know, also listening to the presentation on 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights is, you know, what really strikes me is the absolute lack of vision in the Democratic Party leadership when it comes to, like, actually putting forward an agenda for the American people. So according to this Politico article, which the headline is literally Democratic Party Platform, We're Not Trump. You know, and I mean, full disclosure, I did work on Jill Stein's campaign in 2016. But even back then, it was really, really clear that, you know, staking your entire campaign and the fate of the American people on "we're not the other guy" is the best thing you can say about a path forward for the country. It just doesn't work. It didn't work in 2016. It worked in 2020, but it's, you know, very likely not going to work in 2024. And so, you know, the apparently Trump was mentioned 150 times on 61 out of the document's 80 pages. What kind of a platform is it when three-quarters of your platform is "we're not the other guy"? Wow. You know? And, you know, I mean, what the Democratic Party leadership and the corporate Democrats really, you know, they're so... I don't want to say rudderless, because they're very ruddered to neoliberalism and, you know, the corporate status quo. But there really is no vision to speak of. And, you know, which is in much contrast to what you and Harvey J.K. have put forward. And, you know, if you put those up against the two parties, I mean, okay, I hate to admit it, but Project 2025, as monstrous as it is, it's at least a vision.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not the vision that any of us would ever want, but it's coherent, and it's coherent to its base, right? But it's at least putting forward as like a vision, which, and then on the other side, of course, 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights is a much better vision, and it is a vision. But that's what's really right. Missing from the Democratic Party platform at this point.
It's funny too, because it's sad too, because they do that, of course, with Trump, and again, one of the things about Biden, while I would never expect a Biden to go all the way to the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights, but he sort of gets closer to it and hints at it, and there are things folded in there inside that platform that are better than anything we've seen from a Democratic presidential, because obviously the president is overseeing the platform, mm-hmm. The presidential nominee is putting forward, than we've seen since, I mean, I don't know, I don't think they were at all in Kerry's platform. That would be the only one that maybe would come close to it since Mondale. And so, you know, I know in housing, they actually do advocate for rent control, which is haven't mm-hmm. done ever, you know, mm-hmm. for the Democratic Party. So there's concern around things like that on housing and of course, on child care and child tax credits. And it is definitely more muscular and is a break from certainly orthodox neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it definitely represents some concessions. Mm-hmm. And I think also COVID, I think, played a lot into it. I mean, mm-hmm. I will say, as somebody who, you know, has worked for nonprofits and tribal governments, sort of on the receiving end of a lot of the new funding programs over the last 4 years of Biden, you know, one thing to say about it is that, you know, there was a lot of new funding streams that were innovated and that were made available. You know, and of course, probably COVID was what really pushed that agenda. Who knows what would have happened if COVID didn't happen. But, you know, this is a lot of the story that goes sort of unsaid is that, you know, when a new federal funding stream comes down, and especially like, you know, he proposed a lot of these things to, you know, also as like lip service, right? But even lip service, you know, when those programs, what new programs have a lot of openings for, you know, grassroots organizations, for city governments, for state governments, to really start to define what that program is going to look like, right? And so here is where an opening is, but it really also depends on the grassroots being able to be prepared to push the envelope on that. It's not just at the policy level, but it's really also about how the implementation is and how that funding comes down. So, you know, like, to Biden's credit, over the last 4 years, there were so many new funding programs that came out that there's a lot of opportunities, and we can see that maybe that might, you know, be something again. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act had a lot of opportunities, but it's really up to a progressive grassroots and, you know, people at the down ticket levels of government and also you know, community organizations and everything to take advantage of those opportunities.
And I will say, too, clearly in the Biden administration, too, there have been the National Labor Relations Board has been the best we've had since, boy, I don't know, probably have to go back to Johnson, maybe. Yeah, probably. Then, of course, the regulatory Lena Khan work has been very, very solid. And I think this soft break with neoliberalism, again, I worry that there really isn't that appetite. The vice president doesn't seem to be showing a strong appetite for that. It's not really in her central talking points. And I don't really see it to be central to any of the governors who are being put forward as the likely nominees if for some reason it's not Kamala Harris. The little bit of wiggle room there on Whitmer, but coming from Michigan. And of course, unions are very important to the relative progressivism of, as I said, the NLRB. Okay, so let's go now to... Oh, we lost Cornell? Oh, wow. That was in Cornell West, was it? Yeah. Cornell West was a professor of mine. And a great guy. Malina Abdullah is the vice presidential nominee, KPFK programmer, Malina Abdullah. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant person. So let's hear from Rochelle on line two in San Pedro. Welcome to KPFK, Rochelle. How you doing?
Hi, can you hear me?
I can indeed, yes.
Yeah, so it's Rachel and it's San Pedro.
Oh, okay, thank you. That got them both.
FYI for those of us in Pedro. Cool. Yeah, so I'm driving right now, so I might lose coverage. So I just want to say 2 points. Mm-hmm. Is I'm loving what I'm hearing, and the idea of having it lack poetry. I have a suggestion that we call it Project 2125. And I think that's a really good way to maybe capture the media attention, because what we, you know, we can all talk to each other about this, but we need to capture the attention. And that might be something right now. So Project 2125 is a suggestion.
Oh, wow. Why wait 100 years for that? Why wait 100 years?
No, it's not waiting. We're starting now.
Okay.
We're starting yesterday, Project and it's going to take 100 years to set this right. So,
you know
what I mean? But,
yeah.
But exactly. You know, if it comes out in the media like this, someone's going to ask that question, and we tell them, you know, this isn't. It's, you know, we're going to trump them already, Alan. They're only talking 1 year. We're talking 100 years. So we've already got them beat in the momentum by just framing it that way. And one other thing, and I am going to maybe lose coverage right now, but I started the Cold War Truth Commission that's been going on for 5-6 years. We started with this Economic Bill of Rights of FDR, basically saying, how is it possible that that was only all, you know, almost the law of the land, and yet when Bernie Sanders proposed something very similar, and like you said, we all voted for him, you know, he was ridiculed, thrown out of politics in the party, and he didn't get to be our president. So in the interim of those 75 years was the Cold War. So that's kind of a side issue, but it's a big one. And I also started Burners Against Militarism. I would like to see added to this Economic Bill of Rights something that says, we deserve, you know, point number 7, we deserve a country that's about peace and cooperation in the world. I don't think we can, at this point, just kind of keep it to America and pretend that we don't control 96% of the rest of the world also. So that's just my offering, that we that we add something, that we deserve a country that's about peace and not war and militarism. And we're not going to stand for global competition anymore.
In Progressive Central 2024 will be streamed live from Chicago on August 18th and 19th, and there will be a panel on U.S. foreign policy, and it will be subtitled Recasting U.S. Foreign Policy. That's the title. And the subtitle is International Solidarity and Human Rights. So Recasting U.S. Foreign Policy Towards International Solidarity, meaning with the general population, not U.S. corporate business interests overseas, the welfare of human beings and human society and the planet. Those have to be the what's foregrounded in U.S. foreign policy. Thank you so much, Rachel. I do want to say that two things about the Economic Bill of Rights, and then one of them being very highly relevant for this election cycle, is, you know, when we wrote this, and a big reason that I'm motivated to write this is, if you look at the most wealthy societies in the world and there are countries that sort of have the same level of sort of industrial and technological infrastructure as the United States. The United States is wealthier in general than any country in the world, except on average, you know, sometimes Norway, sometimes Switzerland, pop in there. But generally, of those other 19 countries, the United States does sort of have a larger per capita GDP, which has a lot to do with the family balance sheets of families that have separated suburban houses. That just elevates the general wealth of the households, and those don't really exist in Japan, South Korea, Western Europe, you know, and the other countries that fit into that list. However, in terms of social welfare indices, the United States, with only one or two exceptions, is either at the bottom or way at the bottom, you know? And here you're talking about, you know, really what makes life worth living, you know, levels of depression, how many antidepressants people are taking, drug addiction, households being in disarray, how many people are incarcerated, violent crime rates, gun deaths, and you know, wealth inequality, the quality of the healthcare system, all of these things, the United States, again, is at the bottom or way at the bottom, okay? So at the core of those, I think, are there's deeply endemic poverty in the United States concentrated in certain areas. And that's a very important thing to address in the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights that we go to the heart of. And that in fact, to build a prosperous middle-class society, you cannot have, you know, 25% of the whole population living in at or near abject poverty. To pull that away and to lift people up. And by the way, that would be incredible GDP growth. There's none of those other countries, those 19 other prosperous countries in the world, have a quarter of the population living in the levels of poverty, deep or near poverty. And if you look at, you know, the growth of the GDP in China over the past, what's, you know, one way of looking at it is they brought 400, you know, million people up into the middle class. Well, the United States can bring 75 million people up into the middle class. That's not an option for West Germany, France, Japan, etc. Now, the other thing, too, though, I want to say, and then we'll get to Albert in Utah. Albert in Utah online, and Al from LA in line three in a second. But the if you look at what is really ailing households right now, and herein we are looking at working class households and middle class households in this election cycle, I think there are four big ticket items that, again, J.D. Vance and Donald Trump are not addressing, and the Democrats are not addressing adequately, but they are addressed in the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. And they go across the whole range of people's lives. First of all, the cost of having a child, by which, of course, you can say child care, the cost of child care. But the cost of having a child, that breaks family finances. The cost of higher education breaks family finances. Sometimes K through 12 education can break families' finances. So then, of course, housing, the cost of housing, and how it is impossible right now to buy a new house if you are just coming into the marketplace. And then finally, of course, health care, mainly impacting people late in life. All four of those big ticket items are the things that have basically precluded the possibility of the achievement of the American dream. Okay, I think we address these, and they do not address those in either of the parties, but go ahead.
Yeah, can I mention something and ask you about something before we go to the next caller?
Sure.
Because, again, thinking about Vance and the populism from the Republican Party, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Rural New Deal, which is your other the other major progressive policy. You know, again, it's not something that I think would ever be on Kamala Harris's radar.
Or the Democratic Party's radar.
Yeah, rural areas across the United States have been abandoned by both parties. And, without a progressive alternative, the populism is very rampant.
But actually literally abandoned by the Democratic Party, actually abandoned by the Republican Party. In fact, rural and small-town America are practically one-party states, just like major population centers are. Right. Well, they don't particularly look – well, of course, look, it's just like the Democratic Party running West Virginia in precipitous decline.
Right.
West Virginia goes from being a heavily Democratic state to being a fully Republican state because while the Democratic Party is running West Virginia, it goes into precipitous decline. So right now you have a situation across rural and small-town America, incredible dissatisfaction with the state of the society and the deep poverty, the crises we all know around fentanyl and depression and psychological issues, et cetera, and the sense of just a, you know, look, small-town America has been in decline, and any society which is just notably in decline en masse, there's some beautiful small towns across America, but many, many and most have seen this sort of drift into decline. Anytime you have that, that is, among other things, it is, setting the table for some very ugly politics, and we see those around the country. I'll talk about the Rural New Deal in detail, though, after we get to – let's try Albert in Utah. Listening in Utah on line one. Albert, how you doing over in Utah?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. How you doing?
Good, because it was very low, but I was listening. I support the Equal Sustainable Bill of Rights that first thing that it does is to reduce the human footprint per average – one Earth. We are now at two Earths per average. And the average is the truth because that distribution is not linear, is very non-linear. Half of the population on the planet already lives between $0 and $4 per day. So what we are going to ask them, give me your shirt. They don't have even shoes. So that's not very progressive or anything to sustain economies that go beyond the resources of the planet. Then I support massive eco-sustainable re-education in schools and universities, because the training that we receive in schools and universities at the moment is to exhaust, abuse, criminally abuse right. the resources mm-hmm. of the planet.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then I also support that Bill of Rights, universal, eco-sustainable green income, not the universal basic income, because basic income is business as usual, is a crutch to the capitalist system that continues abuse of resources and consumption ad infinitum to forever. And then a Bill of Rights, economic Bill of Rights, that vows to eliminate plastics, fossil fuels, pollutants, mm-hmm. synthetic chemicals, pesticides, persistent chemicals, PFAs, which there is not just one PFA, there's 15,000 of them in the environment.
Well,
so that needs to go first, and not the discussion that you are having.
Well, I will push back on you.
And I've been listening for you for the last 15 minutes, and I didn't interrupt you, and I would like to not be interrupted as well.
Well, we are going to move on from your call in a second.
In all of those things, we need to redesign our homes, we need to put solar energy on the rooftops.
Well, thank you, sir.
I'd like,
thank you.
I'd like
thank
to
you,
say something to that. Yeah. So I'd like to speak to that, Albert.
Go ahead, Mel. Because let me just say too, it is our radio show, and the callers only get so much time. But the thing too is, what he's saying, most of everything he said, we agree with. But you know, you're just simply not going to win elections unless you address the top concerns of the voting public as they understand them at the moment, and that's what the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights says. Go ahead.
Well, and of course, there's a lot of opportunity to address the climate crisis and that simultaneously. I mean, we still have the Green New Deal that's on the table, a lot of policies being developed on that end, and also, you know, like again, the Biden's climate package was not as ambitious as we would have hoped, but again, like I said, when there are new programs on the table, right? It's not just kind of like waiting for them or the guy at the top to do it for you. Okay, this is part of it, right? So you know when things like climate funding and other things get proposed, right? Like what do they call it, notice of funding opportunity comes out, right? And so, you know, who are the ones that are, and that's an opening. So it can be captured by grassroots organizations working with local governments and, you know, a lot of good people in local government, especially in rural areas, that are really trying to think about how to, you know, to like revive rural economies and provide jobs, right? These could be jobs programs, but only if the grassroots are able to step in and be part of that conversation. You know, I'll tell you, as somebody who does work intimately with federal funding streams, is that, you know, if there isn't like alternative proposals coming from local communities, the number one people who get it are the top five corporations. There are five corporations that do FEMA work all over the country.
Right.
There are five corporations that do, you know, a lot of this infrastructure work. And so, you know, that's sort of, you know, the, like, you know, if Trump doesn't win and we somehow get Biden or Harris in there, you know, that's also a moment for progressives and leftists all over the country to be able to go and engage with, like, where you're at, to be able to make sure that you define these new programs in ways that that benefit local communities. And that's my soapbox right there.
And let's go to Al from L.A. for a couple minutes, then we got to start wrapping, and I'll say a little bit about the Rural New Deal. But Al from L.A., welcome to KPFK.
Hello, yes. This is Al from Huntington Beach.
Hey.
Is that who you're talking about?
Yep, that's you, Al. Take it away.
Okay, cool, man. I'm thinking we should do a fighting retreat. I was watching this one guy on video, and he was saying incumbency is one of the like eight keys to getting reelected.
Yeah, Alan Lincoln. Yeah. Mm, yep.
Mm. And so we need to go with that. Let him run and let him fight it out, and hopefully Trump keeps making these 2-hour speeches and weakens himself. we should also be telling George Clooney and Barbara Streisand and all these other donors that, hey, we understand that. We're going to go and we're going to win in the Senate and the House and take back the judicial system and straighten that out, impeach Clarence Thomas and all these other people and that are, you know, corrupted. And we also are going to, you know, put somebody other than Pelosi in there who's too busy watching her stocks to run the government. And we also need to get rid of Citizens United and have publicly funded elections because both feed from the same trough. And if you want to get all these progressive agendas passed, you need to get the money out of politics. And that's what's pissing so many people off, and they see Trump as a disruptor.
Yeah.
And because both sides are like, you know, well, they both get sponsored by the corporations. They both move the jobs overseas and to Mexico, and then they blame it on China because, you know, all their corporations are making record profits. No. You guys, we have to go step by step, first things first, get rid of Citizens United, get publicly funded elections, get our elections thing back in line, and then go after these progressive agendas simultaneously.
Thank you so much, Al. And I think we're going to head towards wrapping up. So, LaVerge, we apologize, but we're going to wrap up now towards the top of the hour. And thank you so much for calling in, and keep calling in to KPFK and on the call-in shows, and let everybody know about the station. And we certainly really appreciate all the callers, including you, LaVerge, who unfortunately hasn't been able to get onto the call. Melissa did ask about a rural New Deal, and let me just frame it this way. The 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights, in terms of economics, again, not environmental issues and economics, it is the sort of umbrella framing that we're using. And underneath it, again, as I said, it's very important for us to address the places in society where there's deep endemic poverty. And I sort of have seen them as concentrated, very concentrated in a few parts of American society. And one is small town and rural America. So we've already put forward a brilliant document co-authored with Anthony Flaccavento from the Rural Urban Bridge Initiative. And, of course, the progressive policies in rural and small town America really speak to the needs of the people there much better than what the Republicans have put forward there. And, of course, we know that winning votes in rural and small-town America is a heavy lift for the Democratic Party right now, but you're certainly not going to get anywhere until you start putting forward policies that work for the communities and the people and the planet out there. So then, and people, believe me, the people out there also are responsive to these proposals. So check that out, the Rural New Deal. We are developing a 21st century template for urban renewal because, of course, there is deep poverty at the heart of major metropolitan areas and population centers in the United States. We all know about that. And there's also deep poverty is still concentrated in the Southeast in the United States. So we are developing a progressive Southern strategy. And then a fourth area that I would say is very distinctive is in indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So we'll be working with tribes and indigenous communities to develop that. We've made some progress with the progressive Southern strategy, which is about to launch. The 21st century template for urban renewal is going to be a little bit further down the pike from PDA, and then the indigenous poverty addressing it. And the idea is to lift up all of the communities in all of these places up to the level of middle-class Americans. There is no reason that a society with this much wealth and this many resources should have these pockets of deep entrenched poverty. And with that, Melissa Figueroa, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you. Thank you. And you know, thank you for putting forward these proposals. You know, if you really want to win, you really want to, like, shortcut those Republican culture war wedges, you got to be the people with the plan. So
there we
I'm
go.
Glad you have a lot of plans.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm Alan Minsky. I'm currently the Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, formerly the Program Director here at KPFK Radio. Sly Rivers is up next. And great to see him and the other people I get to see as I come into the station here. Support KPFK whenever you can. Of course, big shout out to Susie Weissman, who is up with her family, where she grew up in Montana. And Susie Weissman will be back next week with another Beneath the Surface. Of course, I want to thank Professor Harvey J.K., Melissa Figueroa, and I'm Alan Minsky signing off for Beneath the Surface.